ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This conversation includes content that may be sensitive for some listeners. Please take care when listening.
Colm McCann is an Irish writer. His novels include A Paragon and Let the Great World Spin, books which have won many awards and been bestsellers all around the world. His new book, though, is something different. It's called American Mother, and it was written with Diane Foley. Diane's son, Jim, was kidnapped and murdered by ISIS in 2014. A video of Jim's brutal execution in the Syrian desert was watched around the world. It became an instant, terrible symbol of the barbarity of the Islamic State jihadist group. Diane and Colm worked together to tell the story of Jim's life and how it was much more than its awful end. But the book is equally a portrait of Diane, of both her grief and of her remarkable grace. Hi, Colm.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. It's wonderful to have you on Conversations. Let's begin with you and your involvement in this story, Colm. Why did you first reach out to Diane Foley?
Well, I love the way you put it. It's very much more than its awful end. I think we all experienced at that particular moment when we saw the video or the photograph of Jim Foley in the desert in his orange jumpsuit, beside him the man in the black balaclava with the knife in his hand. And I don't need to go into any more detail about that particular video. But later that same day, my own inbox got sort of flooded with photographs from friends. And it wasn't the photograph that I aforementioned. It was a photograph of Jim Foley in a bunker, turned out to be Afghanistan, didn't know it at the time. And he was sitting in the midst of war and he was reading a book that I had written called Let the Great World Spin. And if you can imagine the sort of conflict of emotions, you know, juggling these two photographs, one against the other, and it was very much on my mind. So I printed the photograph out. And each day for the next few months, I would sort of have this little conversation with the spirit of Jim. And I decided then to write to his mother, because I'd seen her on television. And I said to her, if ever you'd like somebody to write about you or to write about your son, please, you know, consider me. And I never heard from her.
You never heard from her?
No.
So when did that change?
So it changed 7 years later when I had gone to the Middle East myself. I'd written a book called A Paragon. And I was on a Zoom call with Marquette University, which was the university that Jim Foley had gone to. And they were studying the book. And they said, by the way, Diane Foley is on the line. I talked with her. She said, oh, my word, I never got your email. And so I said, can I call you? And so after the Zoom call, I talked with her. And it turned out that she had a contract to write a book, but she'd never been able to do it. And I said, well, listen, I'm going to drive up. I live in New York. And I'm going to drive up to your house in New Hampshire. And we should just all have a chat. She was looking for a way to tell her story. When I got there, though, she told me the most amazing thing, Sarah, was that she was about to go down to a courthouse in Virginia to meet her son's killer.
And what did she want you to do?
Well, her husband didn't want to go, and her sons didn't want to go, and I understand that. And she wanted to go for several reasons. She has a deep faith. She also wanted to, you know, to believe that her son would have gone, which is chilling to think of, like to think of a man going to meet his own killer. She also wanted to communicate to Alexander Cody, who was the name of the British jihadist who had been involved in the killing, that he had not really taken her son's life, that his voice was still there. So she said to me, Colm, will you go along? And I said, absolutely.
So your book, American Mother, begins with this quite extraordinary meeting between Diane and one of her son's killers. But let's first go way back in Jim's story and tell me something about his life as a kid. Where did Jim Foley grow up?
He grew up in pretty suburban America, more or less white picket fence, New Hampshire, New England, sort of. He didn't have any sort of wild youth. He was an altar boy. And, you know, he played football and he did ice skating and he got in a few escapades, as we all did when we were young. He went to a Jesuit school and he wasn't sure what he would do. So he did a thing called Teach for America, which is a volunteer organization where you go and you teach in inner city schools. And that was the beginning of his engagement with what I see as a sort of like deep, vibrant social activism and awareness of other people. He went on then to become a journalist.
His family had strong ties to the military, didn't it?
Yeah. He was the only one who wasn't involved with the military. He ended up getting embedded with the 101st Airborne, who went to Afghanistan. But his other three brothers and his sister ended up either in the Air Force or in the Army. And so there were strong military ties.
But Jim was more, as you say, Colm, kind of interested in social justice activity in a range of different ways. He was teaching in inner city schools and then he taught in Phoenix, Arizona, with a group of juvenile delinquents, people in prison. Yeah. And there are some parallels here between his story and your own life.
You know what's funny, Sarah, is that when I went up to see Diane and her husband, John, after about an hour or two talking to them, they said to me, "Oh, you remind me of our Jim." And I thought, well, that's extraordinary. And I actually stayed in a room that he would have stayed in their house. And then I began to notice lots of different parallels, between us, you know. Well, we're both writers. We both worked with juvenile delinquents. We're both sort of attracted to some sort of vague edge and interested in the stories of other people. And in fact, I really now truly believe that we would have been good friends.
Hmm.
And in certain ways, I know this, I don't want me to sound weird, but he sits on my shoulder sometimes and he whispers in my ear. He's 10 years dead now, of course, but his spirit is still very much alive.
So he really started working as a journalist in his early 30s, and his first big journalism jobs were with the American military. He was embedded as a journalist in Iraq and Afghanistan. What sort of stories was he wanting to tell or most interested in telling from the front line?
He was interested in the relatively anonymous corners of human experience. So he was interested in the soldiers, where they came from, what they did on a daily basis. He was also the sort of journalist who would go into the marketplace and he'd find the old man sitting in the corner playing chess and he would talk to him, or he'd interview the young girl on the way to school with her backpack full of books. So those stories, those human interest stories that were tiny but epic at the same time.
He liked to quote, "War is fought by human beings."
Right. War is fought by them and suffered by them, and he recognized it. He had a deep insight, I believe, into pain, suffering, an empathy that got into the way he constructed his stories, but also the way that he constructed his life. Even later on, when he was, taken hostage, he was known as the person in the prison cell who would look after all the other ones. And so he was always looking after others.
In 2011, Jim headed over to Libya as a freelance journalist to cover the Arab Spring. How did his mom and the rest of his family feel about that?
They were a little bit, worried about him. But you know what? They were more worried about the other kids because the other kids were very much, considered to be on the front line. What they didn't really know was that Jim was a freelance journalist, a conflict journalist, and he was getting in probably deeper than his siblings were. He was going towards the edge. In fact, in certain ways, he was becoming the edge. And, he would go and talk to leaders and fighters in quite dangerous situations. And, most news organizations would not have allowed their journalists to go into the positions that Jim and a number of other conflict journalists wanted to go into.
And in fact, he was kidnapped. This was where he was kidnapped for the first time working as a journalist in Libya, and a colleague of his was shot dead at that kidnapping. How did he get out of that?
Well, that shooting haunted him. It was a South African colleague who got shot dead right in front of his eyes. And then he spent the next 40 days in captivity. It was a series of negotiations and some amount of luck and some amount of cajoling that eventually got him and the rest of his fellow hostages out of Libya. And then he came back to the United States. And, you know, people thought he was going to remain in the States and that maybe... he wouldn't go back to the war front again.
When he was back in the States, Colm, Jim talked a lot about the importance of something he called moral courage. What did that mean to him?
Well, he said, look, I have physical courage. And it is one thing to have physical courage as a reporter and, you know, as a person who lives in this violent world of ours, but it is more important to have moral courage. And what he was talking about was, you know, bringing the stories of others, believing that in the power of the word, believing in the redemptive aspect of storytelling, and a courage to tell the truth, even if the truth sometimes hurt. Sometimes, you know, he was telling things that weren't necessarily going to make the people wave the stars and stripes, you know, on the front lawn. He was telling it like it was, and there was some bad things unfolding in front of his eyes, and he needed a moral courage to tell what he saw, and was actually very much so, in my opinion anyway, the deep truth.
So with that motivation, shortly after celebrating his 39th birthday with his family, Jim went to Syria to report on the conflict there. Did his brothers, his mum, try to talk him out of going somewhere, which was a whole nother level of danger, again, physical danger?
His mum, Diane, didn't try to talk him out of it, but his brothers were upset. One brother in particular was upset because he'd spent a lot of time getting Jim out of Libya at first. And they're like, come on, man, what are you doing? You're going over there again. Don't you think that you're putting yourself in danger? And Jim's response was that he had to do it. He knew that, you know, there was a danger in going there, but... he was compelled to tell the story. Some people say that he put himself in harm's way. He wouldn't have thought so. He would have felt that it was his imperative, his moral imperative, to go and to bring these stories back to the rest of the country.
How did things go for him in Syria at first?
Not too bad. I mean, he was he was that sort of journalist who would be hanging out at the hotel, you know, by the bar, I'm sure, having a few scoops and then running off to get other stories and being in the maelstrom of that that incredible sense of storytelling and you know that really electric edge of finding out what was going on, you know, in front of him. So he was beginning to make a name for himself and sending back some fantastic reports from the front.
Was he able to be in contact with his family during that period? I mean, did Diane speak to him while he was in Syria?
Yeah, all the family holidays, he would call, and he would call, you know, once a week or so, and he would be in touch with them, and they sort of expected him to be in touch. But it would come the Thanksgiving, when the Thanksgiving telephone call didn't come, that's when Diane and her family thought, "Uh-oh, there's something wrong," and they were right. There was something wrong.
They got news from a colleague, a journalist colleague of Jim's, that he'd been taken inside the Syrian border. And Colm, you know, I imagine that the FBI, the Justice Department, all those moving parts of the US military and political machinery swing into action when an American is kidnapped. Is that what happened?
Guess what? No. Incredibly, you know, there was a lethargy there. There was a sense that, you know, I'm sorry, Diane, but we don't really know where your son is. And, you know, she was quite convinced that they would swing into action, just like you said. And there was no action plans in place. There was zero hostage policy, no plans for any sort of negotiation, even covert negotiation. And she was completely stunned when they came to her and when she realized that he was kidnapped and taken hostage. She was stunned when they said, "You will be prosecuted if you try to get money for your son and pay the ransom."
So the American policy was, under no circumstances do we meet the demands of kidnappers.
Zero circumstances. Now, what was hard for her was that the Spanish hostages got out. They were alongside Jim. The French got out. The Danish were allowed, the Danish family was allowed to pay. And so Diane, over the course of this long hostage taking that was going on, had to watch this with increasingly disconsolate and stunned, in fact, that that she, and she knew that the British and the Americans were not going to negotiate. And that sense of doom sort of slowly crept up. It was amazing, really.
I imagine that if Jim had been in the military or a politician, it would have been a very different story. Was the government kind of washing their hands of him to a degree because he was there as a freelance journalist?
Yeah, and it wasn't just journalists. It was aid workers too. I mean, it was a really extraordinary abandonment of the citizenry. At the time, the policy was, we do not talk with terrorists, we do not negotiate, full stop, and we will not engage in any manner or means. They did eventually try an operation, but it was only after all the other hostages had been freed by the other countries, and it was way too late.
At that early stage, Colm, did the Foley family know anything about where Jim was? You know, who had him, what they wanted? Was there any communication at first?
There was communication. There were notes going back and forth. There was guesswork as to where he was possibly located. The Global Post, whom he had worked for, an online news organization, had put a team in place, and they had a fair idea where Jim might be. They communicated this with the FBI, but they didn't hear really anything back. I mean, all of this was a series of failures and mistakes, and quite honestly, it was bumbling. The more I heard the story, the more stunned I became at the lack of engagement from the US government.
A year after Jim was taken, the family got an email from the kidnappers. What did they say?
Well, it was written in a strange language. There was a British tinge to the words, using the words like whilst instead of while, and so on. They demanded an exorbitant amount of money. Diane knew at that stage that not a lot was going to happen to release her son. But they did try to communicate with the kidnappers, but that communication broke down very, very quickly.
As those other hostages from other countries, European countries, were released, Diane and her family learnt, you know, awful, harrowing details about what life was like in captivity for those men and women taken hostage. Why were the kidnappers referred to by Jim and the other hostages as the Beatles?
Well, there's a couple of reasons why they were called the Beatles. The traditional reason that people think it was because they were British and they had these Cockney accents, and there was four of them, and so they would have been called, you know, the Beatles, the group. But also it was a horrible, awful play on the word beat, because they were being beaten. Some of the torture techniques were quite awful. Diane didn't know about them at the time. She knows about them now, and there's still things that haunt her mind. But the people who were kidnapped called them the Beatles because, they were being beaten. There was no music to that particular thing.
How did Jim and his colleagues there, or the other hostages, try and keep themselves sane? under those awful circumstances?
They told stories. They played games. They played the game of Risk. They used little sticks and stones from the cell. They told the plots of novels that they liked. They swapped poems. They prayed. They argued with one another. They shared things with one another. They told each other stories. We know all this because, some of the hostages got out. And there was an incredible camaraderie that went on there. We can only imagine what it must be like to be in a cell with 13, 14 other people and trying to make sense of the world around you. And bizarrely, one of the things that Jim used to talk about, and I didn't know any of this, and I don't even include it in the book because it just seems too self-referential, but he used to narrate the plot of one of my books, the one that he liked.
Colin, that's such an extraordinary thing to hear. You were there in a sense, or your words were there.
I know. It's still something that gives me the shivers. I don't really talk about it all that much because it still pierces me to think that, that my words had meant something to him. And then, of course, his language was taken from him. And then I get given the chance afterwards to reinstate that language by telling his story and his mum's story. It's a redemptive circle. Mm.
A Danish hostage who was released had memorized a letter from Jim to his family. Mm-hmm. What sort of thing did he want to tell them? What did he want them to know?
It was so lovely. He was scared. Daniel Otteson was scared to carry the letter out in his shoe or in his clothing, so he decided to memorize it. The minute he got out, he called Diane and he told her over the phone all the things that Jim wanted to say. I miss you. I miss my grandmother. Say hello to my nephews and I'm praying for you. All these like supremely ordinary but beautiful things that totaled up to a real sort of poem, if you will, a poem of longing. And he's saying, I will be all right and I will see you and I will be home. And one can only imagine what that meant, not only to Jim to have his words being communicated, but to Daniel, who learned that letter off by heart. I think it was amazing.
Jim had been held hostage for almost 2 years, and Diane and her family were doing everything they could think of to try to secure his release. But then in August 2014, almost 10 years ago now, they got a phone call from a journalist. And what did they hear?
Well, the journalist called Diane at home. Diane picked up the phone and the journalist said, have you seen Twitter? And Diane said, no, I haven't seen Twitter. And then the journalist broke down. She broke down in tears. She said, I will call you back. She couldn't summon the language to tell a mother what she had seen online. And so Diane then immediately opened up her internet and awfully, she saw the image that the rest of us saw, and she thought at first that this can't be true. This is not something that can ever be true. This is photoshopped, and it's almost horrific to say it, but what she saw was a photograph of her son with his head resting upon his back. Now, what did she do? Obviously, like all mothers, she broke down in tears. But she also has, and I learned this as I got to know her, a tremendous resolve. And almost immediately, in the first few days, she resolved that she was going to make something of her son's moral courage and engagement with life. People started sending her stuff from Australia, from Ireland. They send money, they send notes. They sent crucifixes. They sent all sorts of things and artwork and things. And she said, okay, there's something here. And we have failed. We have failed as a country. We've failed as a nation. We've failed as a culture. And I'm not going to fail any longer. And so she started the James W. Foley Legacy Foundation, which now has changed the whole landscape of wrongfully detained and hostages around the world.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski.
Colm, you say that Diane channeled her grief almost immediately into setting up a foundation to try and help other hostages and their families. But just back to those first hours, days in that family home, what else got her through personally?
She has an incredible faith. It was prayer for her. This was something that, you know, I couldn't necessarily understand at first. I grew to understand it the more I got to know her. But her deep faith, a deep Catholic faith, that somehow something would come of this. Faith, then also family. And it sounds, you know, very sort of, suburban American, you know, God and family and all those things. But she was also angry. She was angry at her government. She was angry at the way that she had been treated. She wasn't going to let that anger turn her bitter. So she prayed that she wouldn't become bitter. And then she also prayed that she'd be able to do something that would turn this whole story inside out.
You grew up in Catholic Ireland, Colm. So did that mean that it was easier for you to engage with this fundamental part of Diane's story? Or do you think it was differently challenging for you to come at this material in the way that was true for her?
I don't know. I mean, I kind of joke that I'm not just a lapsed Catholic, but I'm a collapsed Catholic. But I did have an upbringing where, you know, I saw this sort of faith manifested in different ways. I have a real deep faith in humanity, and I also have a really deep faith in storytelling. And I think those things aligned. When I thought about humanity, when I thought about storytelling, and I thought about her own faith in God, I thought all of these things go into it like a peculiarly wonderful stew that gives me some sense of optimism, even in all the darkness. But my upbringing in Catholic school was a little bit like Jim's, because he went to a Jesuit school and I went to a Christian Brothers school in Dublin. But the idea of action and taking action and believing in others was important to both of us.
On what would have been Jim's 40th birthday, Diane and John, Jim's dad, went out to dinner together. What did they return to?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. People are good. and despite this world that we live in right now, which seems diseased with certainty and people like all in these narrow lanes of understanding, let's not forget that even in this crazy world, there will be acts, spectacular acts of kindness and goodness. They went out to dinner and it was going to be his 40th birthday. And what do they come back to? But the whole lawn lit up with 40 candles. And, can you imagine what that felt like? It meant you're not alone. People recognize your grief. And there was a sort of power in that. Now, her husband is different. John was different. John wanted to sort of retreat and come indoors and hold his grief privately, which is perfectly, perfectly fine. Diane said, "No, I'm going to take this energy, and I'm going to continue to build this foundation." And all these envelopes came, cash, you know. Cash, just like there. What was she going to do with it? She wasn't going to go down the store and buy anything. She said, "I've got to do something." All these people didn't have return addresses, and she wasn't going to return it. Something really powerful was born then.
In 2018, two of the British ISIS members who'd been responsible for Jim's kidnapping and murder were captured in Syria and then brought eventually to the US for trial. This was the point in the story, Colm, where you got to know Diane and she invited you to join her at a meeting with one of Jim's killers who was in jail in Virginia. How did that meeting come about between them in the first place? Why was that even suggested?
This is another really interesting part of this story. You know, these guys were captured in northern Syria. They were stripped of their British citizenship. The American government promised that they wouldn't exert the death penalty. And so they were brought to Virginia to go on trial. Now, they weren't sent to Guantanamo and they weren't sent to Abu Ghraib. It was a whole new phase in American justice looking at these people and giving them a chance to go on trial. One of the killers pleaded guilty. His name is Alexander Cote. He pleaded guilty on all counts to conspiracy to murder, hostage taking, torture, etc. And part of his plea agreement, stunningly, was that he would agree to talk to the victims, because they were still living victims, and the families of victims. And guess who the very first person was who said, I will go and I will talk to him and I will sit down in front of him and I will look him in the eye? Diane Foley.
What did she want from that meeting? I mean, did she even know what she wanted?
That's a good question. You know, so much of the time we clarify our motives afterwards and we pretend that we knew all along what we wanted. But I was alongside her and, you know, neither of us knew what we wanted from that meeting. Did we want to know where the body was buried? Did we want to make him cringe? Did we want to make him suffer? Did Diane want to forgive him? Did Diane want to just show this amazing Christian compassion? Or was it all of these things all together, including the fact that she wanted to say, you did not take my son away. My son still lives because the power of his story still lives. So we went down there and we walked into that big echoey room in the center of a Virginia courthouse. No windows. There was plenty of people in the room. There were FBI agents, court clerks, there were defense people, prosecutors, they were all milling around. Diane walked into the room. The room goes silent. She walked across the floor. She sat down at this table, no more than 4 feet from Alexander Cote. He was in his prison jumpsuit. He had shackles on his ankles. And guess what she said? She said, "Hi, Alexander. It is nice to meet you."
How do you understand that, Colin?
I understand it as great grace. I understand it as courage. I understand it as a moment where the genius of compassion shows through. I understand it as a fact that we can actually change the world if we do take these big leaps of faith and try to understand where other people are coming from. I knew I was in the presence of an extreme human moment. And I just sat down alongside them and watched them both as they volleyed back and forth for over the course of 2 days and then another day, 3 days in total. 6 months later, we had a third day with them.
And what did they talk about?
Oh, wow. What didn't they talk about? Well, they talked about faith. And they talked about war. They talked about the rules of war, rules of engagement, about why did you do this? You know, what was your upbringing like? He talked about being beaten as a teenager. He talked about his, conversion from Greek Orthodox to Islam. He talked about being radicalized. He talked about going to Syria. She talked about Jim. She talked about his upbringing. She talked about her own faith. They talked about compassion. And then at one stage, he opened up a folder that he had on the table in front of him. And he slid the photograph of his own three children across the table. And this was not an act. Some of it was acting, you know, over the course of the couple of days. I could tell. We could all tell. But this part of the day was not an act. And that man, you know, a British ISIS fighter who had seen the extremes of human things and committed terrible, terrible torture and so on, he broke down in tears. And so did Diane. And it was a moment where they recognized how acutely sad this whole thing was. It was sad for Diane because she had lost her son. It was sad for him because he'd lost his freedom. It was sad for his daughters because they would never see their dad again. It was sad for, you know, legions of people that they all knew. And it was a powerful moment then because it did lead to a form of understanding and forgiveness. And I know some people might think that's weird, you know, That's kind of, how dare you say that we can understand our enemy in those ways? But she did. And it was really, really enormously powerful.
Did she want or an apology or seek an apology? I mean, I don't know what apology could touch the enormity of what she had suffered, yeah. Her family had suffered. But was that part of that conversation at all?
I still ask myself, was she looking for an apology? She got what was a very close to an apology, an all-out apology. But it was still slightly qualified. But it didn't matter to her. Even if he had ranted and raved, she would have gone and she would have sat there in front of him. Even if he had spewed hatred, which he didn't, she would have listened to him. She was there because some form of grace, which she would call the Holy Spirit, and I would call, you know, a deep, engaged humanity, wanted to know who this other person was, and wanted then, in a sort of Scheherazade-like notion, to keep her son alive by telling the story. And so it was amazing, and she was gratified by the quality of the meeting. There were some things that disturbed us, as I said, disturbed us all. And I did feel that at a certain stage he thought that he was cleverer than she was, and he absolutely wasn't. And Diane Foley happens to be one of the most deeply emotionally intelligent people that I have ever come across in my life. She might not say it in big language or, you know, fancy metaphors, and her voice is simple and clear, but it is simple and clear with a grace like it's hard to imitate. As a writer, I tried to capture that as much as possible.
Some people called her a saint for doing this column. You know, it's not something her husband John could do, and I think for many people the idea of sitting opposite the man who'd been involved in the brutal torture and murder of your son is almost an impossible thing to countenance. But how did Diane think about that term, saint?
She doesn't like the idea of being called a saint, because she thinks that what she did was what every mother would do. She loved her son. And she, you know, every mother loves their children and will protect them in whatever way they can. She did it in a different way. But here's the rub. You know, she has this incredible faith. And not only did she do this with her son's killer, but she walked out of the meeting and she went immediately down to Congress and knocked on doors, knocked on the doors of senators, knocked on the doors of all sorts of politicians, philanthropists and funders, and said, we need to change the way we think about hostages, hostage taking. And in fact, she also says, we need to change the way we think about war. Because that war was wrong. And so much of what had gone on in the name of, you know, the United States, it was wrong. And we call this book American Mother. And people think that's a sort of rah-rah, sort of patriotic thing. No, her patriotism was in saying that, you know, she was upset at her government. We did wrong. We need to be better. And that was her main message. We can do better than this.
What was it like for you, Colm, to sit in that room? I mean, such an unique experience for someone to have, to bear witness to that interaction, to find yourself in that moment in history. What was it like for you those days?
It was pretty amazing, I have to say. This is going to sound a little odd, but I kind of liked him. I looked across the table at him when we sort of knew each other. And I knew, you know, he'd grown up in British working class he had become politically engaged. What was really fascinating about all of this, Sarah, is that he had a book in front of him on the table. And I was dying to know what the book was, and I eventually asked him. And it was Patrick Radden Keefe's book, Say Nothing, which is about Northern Ireland. And I had blurbed the book. So my name was on the cover of the book right there in front of him. He didn't know at that stage that I was a writer. I was introduced as a family friend. And then he heard the accent and stuff, and he started asking me about the IRA, structures of cells and things like that. And he had also been sort of characterized as a thug, a football thug, a hooligan, you know. And turned out he didn't go to football games at all. And he was actually quite smart and interesting. So it was, for me, there was this riot of emotions. I also viscerally wanted to protect Diane. So I got a little bit stroppy with him at times. In fact, at one stage, I basically got kicked out, and he was the one who asked the prosecutors and the defence for me to come back.
What got you kicked out?
Did you beat him? Did you waterboard him? Where is the body buried? How do you, like, really direct questions that rattled everybody, except him, because he knew the truth around it. And also, I have to be honest, Diane had asked me to ask some of the tougher questions. So part of me was doing it on her behalf. But some of the people in the room took exception to some of the tough questions that I asked him. But we got a lot of truth out of him. And we did get this spectacular human moment and this human story. At the very end, when they sort of come together and stand up to say their goodbyes, I think it was one of the most powerful human moments that I've ever witnessed.
Do you think in some way there was a kind of relief for him in being held accountable in such a direct and emotional way by his victim's mother?
That's a good way to put it, yeah. I think there was. I think he was in also, I don't want to sit too much on the couch in relation to this, because you can overanalyze these things. But I think in a certain way he wanted to talk to his own mother. And Diane is such an open person that he felt that as he talked to her, he was somehow communicating across the Atlantic back to London, where his mum still lives. He did, in fact, mention his mum on several times. He'd lost his father when he was 2 years old. His father had committed suicide. And so he had had a fairly tragic life. And I think in certain ways, yeah, he wanted that balm and he wanted that ability to, quote unquote, confess. But he also wanted to communicate through Diane what his own mother meant to him.
American Mother is written in Diane's voice. Tell me about that decision, Colin. Was it always the plan for it to be mainly in first person?
Yeah, well, I wasn't sure. Look, you never know how a book is gonna form. Samuel Beckett says, it is the job of the artist now to find a form that accommodates the mess. And trust me, when you get to a story, you know this. It's like, how am I going to frame this one? But it was that moment when I walked into the courthouse. I knew that I would write that in the third person because I'm witness to it. I didn't want to be a character in the book myself, like Truman Capote or somebody else. I desperately wanted to only to be a fly on the wall. But then I also knew that the most important voice in that room was Diane Foley's voice. And so I talked with her and I taped her and I wrote it down in quote-unquote her voice, and then she edited it. Now, I'm a novelist and I make stuff up, so I had to tame myself, and Diane was very good about this, in fact. Diane laughs about it, and she says, yep, I had to rein in his fictional instincts. And but it made for a good partnership.
Was there a moment or a scene or a sentiment where you thought, ah, yeah, I'm in her voice, I've got it, I can do this? How do you do that, put on the sensibility, particularly of such an extreme experience as this mother?
I've done this all my life. I believe in the value of listening, but I also know that I'm not much more than a decent ventriloquist. You know, I'm a journalist, I'm also an author, but I am empathetic to people. But my job is to become some sort of recorder of the human emotion, not to make a judgment. I don't want to be didactic. I don't want to tell people what to think or how to think. But if I can somehow put you in that room, if I can somehow put you in that life, if I can somehow put you in front of the fridge when she's looking at her son's, photograph on the fridge, and she's opening the fridge door and the light floods her face and all these things that she's thinking, I will have done the thing that I want to do, which is I want people to experience things that lay outside of their own immediate lives, because I firmly believe that we are so much more than one thing or even one person. And that's the beauty of literature for me.
You're the co-founder of an organisation called Narrative 4. How does that organisation and its project connect with what you undertook with Diane?
Well, it's a beautiful organization that takes up my soul, and we're hoping to bring it to Australia sometime very soon. We're in 37 countries around the world, and we're growing. It's an organization that uses storytelling to lead to change, to lead to action on the ground. And what we do is we bring young people together to tell stories to one another, and then they tell those stories back to each other in the first person. In other words, they step into one another's shoes. And it's an act of radical empathy that engages parts of the brain that that are quite extraordinary. And when young people tell these stories, they learn so much, not only about themselves, but they learn about other people. And somehow that leads them to want to change the world. We've done it in schools all across the world, but we've studied it in schools in Ireland and in the United States. Test scores go up, engagement goes up, absenteeism goes down. All of these things occur, and that's because I believe that the world is knit together. Yes, it's knit together with atoms and molecules, and we all know that, but really, it's knit together with one another's stories, and that's how we get to know one another. And that's how we can save one another.
It's such a sort of beautifully simple idea, this idea that you would hear someone else's story and then retell it. But I love that you're not trying to convince the other person of the truth of your story or your opinion. It is just listening.
That's right. And the beauty of it is that it's personal storytelling. It's not storytelling that's trying to win an argument. It's not didactic. It's not saying you should be a Republican or a Democrat, or you should be, you know, a monarchist or whatever else it happens to be. It's all about this tiny little stories from our lives, but the tiny becomes epic. And we begin to see not that the world is easy, and actually the beauty of it is the world is actually messy and kind of nuanced, and like you look at people differently. It's like, oh, I didn't realize that we were actually so close to one another. I thought you were extremely different. I thought I was going to travel in a lane completely opposite and parallel to yours, and we would never meet. And then somehow we tell our stories to one another, and that this is where we meet. And that, to me, is so humanly profound.
So through this process of deeply listening to Diane Foley's story and the story of her son, Jim, how has it left its mark on you? I imagine every book that you write changes you in some way. How has this one left its mark?
Yeah, every book leaves its mark, but this one really left its mark, as did the last one, in fact, A Paragon, where I spent time with an Israeli and a Palestinian fathers who had lost their daughters. But this one is a book that I will live with for my whole life. I know the message of it is important. It's something I want to hold on to. It shifted me. You know, I know it sounds a bit naff, but it made me into a better person. I began to look at Diane, and frankly, you know, we became friends, and she taught me so much about how to engage with people. Also, she brought a sort of calmness to my life. Now, would I be able to do what she was able to do? I would like to think I could. I don't ever want to be in that situation. But I think that if I really look at myself, I think it would be more difficult for me, certainly, than it was for her. And that's why I love and admire her so much, because that courage is amazing. And let's not forget, she was in her 60s when this went down. She's now in her 70s, and she's still going knocking on doors, you know, organizing all sorts of political events and runs and changing legislation and, you know, meeting with presidents and meeting with ordinary people. Also, she's involved with the hostage families and hostages right now, whether you're talking about Venezuela or Russia or Israel or Gaza or wherever else it happens to be. This is a story that sort of trills through every part of our little lives.
Colm, it doesn't sound naff. It sounds beautiful. And thank you so much for sharing your story and Diane's on Conversations.
Thank you so, so much.
Colm McCann's book, written with Diane Foley, is called American Mother. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.